Okay, Dr. Taylor, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, great. Okay, so I want to welcome everybody today to tune in for your Parenting Tune-Up, and it is hosted by the International Network for Children and Families and Wholehearted Parenting. And my name is Catherine Coles, and I'm the author of the book Redirecting Children's Behavior. You have joined this program. This is the second in a six-part series, and our guest speaker today is Dr. James Taylor. And Dr. Taylor has consulted for over 25 years with young people, parents, and educators. He's the author of the book Positive Pushing, How to Raise a Successful and Happy Child, and the author of Your Children Are Under Attack, How Popular Culture is Destroying Your Kids' Values and How You Can Protect Them. He is also, he writes for a newsletter called Psychology Today, and you can get that at psychologytoday.com. So everyone should be muted, and at the end, I will open up the conference for questions. So, Dr. Taylor, let's get started. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
You're welcome. There's quite a list of more things that Dr. Taylor has done, but I just want to get going and with our first question here. So how is positive pushing, your view on positive pushing, different from the old style of positive pushing?
Well, it's interesting because when my agent in New York started shopping my book, Positive Pushing, around, a lot of publishers liked the content, but a number of them said, you have to change the title. It's too much of a hot button issue. Because many people, when they hear the word pushing, they have sort of a cringe factor, and because they associate pushing with some negative things. And I make an important distinction between old-style pushing and positive pushing. Old-style pushing is often negative, it's often angry, and it's often controlling. And it sends a very powerful message that if you don't live up to our expectations, then we won't love you. And a problem with that, of course, is that it's based on that threat of withdrawal of love. And often old-style pushing is about the needs of the parents. Parents push their kids because of parents' needs to feel validated and to feel good about themselves. A problem with old-style pushing, though, is that it works to a point. Because early in a child's life, the most important thing they want from their parents is their love, and they will do anything to get that love. The problem, Catherine, is that sooner or later, usually in their early to mid-teens, they say, wait a minute, I shouldn't have to work that hard to get my parents' love. And that's when they start to push back, and you see a lot of hurt and anger and resentment. Positive pushing, though, is very different. It's by definition positive, it's supportive and encouraging. And it sends a very different message, that we will love you no matter what you do. And another thing about positive pushing is that it's all about what's in children's best interest. Now, when I say what's in the children's best interest, I don't mean what feels good, what's fun, what they like. It means parents knowing what's best for their kids and doing what's best for their kids, even if the kids don't necessarily like it at the time. A final key component of positive pushing is that before parents can push their kids, they need to push themselves. They need to look in the mirror and see what they bring to the table as parents. And as parents, we're also human beings, and we bring hopefully a lot of good stuff from our upbringing to our parenting. But also, let's be realistic, a lot of us bring some baggage. And so encouraging parents to really see what they bring to the table, both good and not so good, and then making sure the messages they're sending their kids are mostly positive ones.
When you say they need to take a look at what they bring to the table, can you say more about that? How do you do that? What kinds of things would you look for about yourself?
Well, looking at your upbringing and seeing in your own life, your own personality, how you think. For example, do you tend to look at the world half full or half empty, glass half full or half glass empty? Do you tend to get frustrated and angry a lot? Do you yell? Are you somebody who is very much of a loner or very social? Do you have a need to please? And there are a lot of ways to figure yourself out. Of course, you can go to therapy. That's always useful. But reading books, going to seminars, just sitting there and pondering and saying, so what strengths do I bring as a parent? And then also, you know, what are some liabilities? What are some messages that I don't want my kids to get that I might communicate to them if I don't know what they are?
Okay. And so you're saying that we have to push ourselves as a parent before we can push our kids, and we need to push ourselves to be the best we can be first. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yes, very much so, because I've come to believe that it's less important what you do to your kids in raising them so much as who you are. Because so much of the messages that kids get from their parents are not the do this, do that, or try this or that. It's just watching their parents and seeing how they react to the world, how they react emotionally, what they say in different situations, how they relate to other people, particularly your spouse or partner. And so these very subtle messages are very powerful to children. So, and very often parents aren't even aware of those messages of who they are that they're communicating to their kids. Because it's not directly at their kids. It's just being who they are in their lives.
So like a person who yells at their child is actually teaching their child to yell to get their way.
Right. They're showing that yelling and express anger is a healthy or reasonable way to express emotion.
Yeah. It's really important that we do look at ourselves. And that's kind of a hard thing to do, because sometimes it's not always that pretty to see ourselves. So one of the questions, too, I had for you is how – this is intriguing for me. You've got success achievers and how that differs from achieving success. So how do you make that distinction?
Right. There are a lot of kids, parents these days, who feel a lot of pressure in this culture of hyperachievement to raise their kids to become successful. And we've heard recently with the Tiger Mom, Amy Chua, she's gotten tons of press about her methods of raising her two daughters in ways that most people in our country would say was really quite abusive. And where the emphasis is all about success, 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 straight A's, virtuosity in performing arts, superstardom in sports. And what I find in my practice, I work with a lot of very successful young people, and yet I find a lot of them are profoundly unhappy. And so those are parents who believe in helping kids to achieve success. I believe, though, that parents should have a different goal, and that is to raise successful achievers. And for me, what distinguishes successful achievers from those who achieve success is that successful achievers are kids who their parents believe that success and happiness are mutually inclusive categories. That kids can't be truly successful unless they're also happy. And I don't mean happy in the la-di-da sense, but I mean just feeling good about themselves, feeling like they're in a good place in their lives. And unfortunately, our culture has sort of said, well, you can either pressure your kids and they'll become successful, or you cannot pressure them and they'll be happy. But certainly success can be a great source of happiness. But at the same time, success alone is not a particularly great predictor of happiness. And an interesting side note to this is that in addition to my work with kids, I work with a lot of very successful business people, professional athletes, and so on. And they are also, many of them, very unhappy because they work toward achieving this great success, and they got there in terms of maybe fame, maybe wealth, maybe status. And yet, so they have all these things that should make them happy, they're told, and yet they're really unhappy. And my feeling is that happiness is a pretty important thing in life, because all the money in the world doesn't really mean a lot if you're just not a happy person.
So how do you do that? How do you make sure that your child is being successful and is happy about it? What are some tips that you might give to the audience about how to do that?
Well, you're sort of asking for a three-hour answer to a 2-minute question. But what I would suggest is let's sort of continue along in the discussion. And really what this interview is about is showing you the different areas in which parents need to focus in order to achieve raise successful achievers.
Okay.
So I think you've got some more questions for me.
Yes. So you have here the importance of self-esteem and where parents have gotten off track. So how have parents gotten off track with this whole thing about self-esteem?
Right, right. Let me just step back for a minute and fill in a little gap. In my book, Positive Pushing, I have what I call the three pillars of successful achievers. And these three pillars are the three qualities that if parents instill them in their children, I believe they're going to be successful achievers, that is, successful and happy children. And so the first one, as you indicate, is self-esteem. And unfortunately, self-esteem is probably the most misunderstood and misused developmental factor of the last 30 or 40 years or so. A bunch of parenting experts back in the 70s said the way to raise kids with self-esteem is to make them feel like that they feel loved and valued. And so they always feel good about themselves. The parents heard this, and they loved and rewarded and reinforced and supported their kids no matter what their kids did. And yes, your kids need to be loved, but not thoroughly unconditionally. Meaning, children need to recognize that if they behave badly, well, they might not receive the love that they want. And so, yes, of course, your children need to feel loved. But these parenting experts left out a very critical part of self-esteem, and that's the importance of competence. The children need to feel competent. They need to feel capable. They need to feel like their actions have consequences. Their actions matter. If I do good things happen. If I do bad things happen. And importantly, if I do nothing, nothing happens. And yet the definition of a spoiled child is basically a kid who, no matter what they do, good, bad, or ugly, they get what they want. And going back to the whole love issue, the problem with that is that our society bought into this idea of needing to constantly love and value their kids. And also, these parents and experts said, you have to make sure your kids never feel bad about themselves. And so what happened then is that parents didn't allow their kids to fail. And, for example, in sports, youth sports now, I have a niece who's, I think, 11 now, and she came back from a soccer tournament last summer with a ribbon around her neck that said, had a little medallion that said, number one winner. And I said, Eliza, what did you get to deserve that? And she says, everybody got one. And Woody Allen famously said that 90% of success is just showing up. But it's that last 10% that life is really all about, and success and meaning is all about. And so kids need to be allowed to fail. Kids need to be able to feel bad about themselves. And they need to realize that feeling good about themselves is not just about always being good and thinking that they're wonderful. It's about feeling loved, and it's about feeling competent.
So can you give me an example of what that would look like? So let's say your child got a D on his report card. What would that look like?
Well, what you would want to do in that situation is say, okay, why did you get a D?
Mm-hmm.
And put it in controllable terms. Did you not work hard? Did you not hand in your homework? Did you not pay attention in class? But the child needs to learn that there are consequences to his actions. And by focusing on that, which is controllable, he can then say, okay, I need to do something different in the future.
Okay. So you said that there were three pillars. What are the other two?
Right. The second one is ownership. And ownership is the connection that children have with the activities that they participate in. You want to have kids who care deeply about what they do. If they care deeply about something, they're going to work very hard at it and feel a deep connection to it and feel a responsibility to it. The problem is that ownership is not something that kids can just get. It's a gift that parents give them very often. Because one thing I see so often with the whole tiger mom, helicopter parents, little league parents, is that they take ownership of their kids' activities. So they make sure that they're doing their homework, and they sometimes do their homework for them, and they're totally micromanaging their lives. And in doing so, kids get two messages. First of all, my mom's always on top of me doing this stuff, so she must not think I can do it. And also, well, my mom's doing everything here, so why should I do it? So you're not going to get a very high level of motivation. And some of the red flags that I look for with a lack of ownership or an overinvestment on the part of parents is when one of the most dangerous words in parenting for me is a simple three-letter word, T-O-O, two. Parents, of course, want to care about their children and love them, but they don't want to care about them too much. They want their kids' activities to be important to them, but not too important. And what happens is a lot of parents, they invest their self-esteem, how they feel about themselves, in their children's activities. And that just steals ownership from their kids because parents have to make sure their kids succeed. Otherwise, the parents feel like failures. And so a couple of red flags here are a real focus on results. A lot of parents love putting the report card up in the refrigerator, putting trophies on the mantle in the living room. I say take them down. Your kids know when they've done good. They don't need to be told that. Also, parents' emotions. I see parents who are more excited after their kids win a soccer game than their kids are, who are more bummed out, more disappointed, more hurt when their kids lose a tennis match than their kids are. If parents' emotions are stronger than their kids, that's a real red flag. A final red flag is what I call the we syndrome. I hear parents say, we won today, or we're going to have a great game, or we got straight A's. Well, I didn't see the parents taking the test or out on the sports field. By saying we, it's saying not you. And for kids to have ownership, it has to be their thing. Parents, yes, can support and encourage, provide resources, get the kids out there on time, attend games and so on, show interest. But it's got to be the kids' thing.
So what would that look like? So your child just won a tennis match. Mm-hmm. What would be the effective thing for a parent to do? What kind of comments or emotions would be effective?
Okay, sure. Win or lose, your kid walks off the tennis court or the soccer field or what have you. If parents can't control their emotions, if they're really upset or incredibly excited, they should stay away from their kid because neither are good messages. The message is you lost and I'm really upset, or you won and I'm so happy. And I've seen parents cry after the kids lose. And in theory, it might be an empathic crying, but the message kids get is, I lost, my mom's really unhappy.
Mm.
And so and another one is, kid walks off the field and they say, good job. Well, maybe it wasn't a good job.
Right.
Or they'll say, boy, did you have fun out there? Well, that presupposes that they didn't have fun, and sports are supposed to be fun. And actually, this is a lesson I learned. I gave a couple of workshops with a fellow named, the father of Mike and Bob Ryan, who are multiple Grand Slam tennis champions, played at Stanford University. I think they won 10 or 11 Grand Slam doubles titles, the twins. And their father, Wayne Ryan, train them, and they're really great young men. They're well-rounded. They play in a band. They're very bright. And what he told parents what they should say is that they should go up to them and say, where do you want to go eat? That's it. Just where do you want to go eat? Because it basically says, you know, how you did. It doesn't matter whether you want to lose. Let's go eat. Parents are there, so that shows that they care enough to be there. But it doesn't put any weight on you know, good job, or you didn't do well, or what did you do wrong. Kids need that space to let them figure things out.
That's so unlike what we have been told. That is so far from what we've been told. That's really a fascinating way of looking at it.
Thank you. Actually, one more thing I want to add about that. I have a whole section in my book on praise. And praise is something that's incredibly misused these days. As an example, the classic feedback that parents are supposed to give their kids, or whether on a playground or a sports field, is good job, good job. And for me, good job is absolutely worthless praise, and it actually can hurt kids. Because what's the point of praise? It's to reinforce behaviors that will lead to future good outcomes. So what good is good job? It offers no information about what kids did to have successfully completed the task, and also it makes it out like a job. It's very outcome focused. So I encourage parents to just erase the phrase "good job" from their vocabulary, because it serves no purpose. The best kind of praise is feedback that tells kids what enabled them to achieve that good goal. So you were really focused in the game. Or, you know, last night you could have gone out with your friends, but you decided to stay home and do work on that school project. And so you're reinforcing the behaviors that enable them to become to have a good outcome. And so the whole praise thing is very much of a pet peeve of mine, because I hear it with teachers, with coaches, with parents, good job, and it's just worthless praise.
So let's go back to the tennis game, okay, for a second.
Sure.
So is it appropriate to say, well, how'd you feel about that match?
You know, most kids don't want to talk to their parents after a match. In fact, I generally tell parents, don't go up to your kids after a competition. They'll come to you when they're ready. Kids need to be left alone. If they did poorly, let them go off, sit on the park bench and cry maybe, or just sit there and go, What happened? Why do I feel this way? I feel terrible. It helps them figure out what they're feeling and come to grips with it. They don't need – parents so often just don't want their kids to feel bad. So they run up to them. What's the first thing parents, especially moms, do when their kid's walking off the field crying? They go up to them and hug them and placate them and assuage them and distract them. The parents hate to see their kids feel bad. But the kids need to feel bad, because that's how they figure out how to feel good.
Wow, that's very, very cool. I like that a lot. So then you just leave them alone, and then they come to you. You don't say anything until they come to you?
Right, right. And let them have their space, and if they at some point they might ask, well, how do you think I did? Or, you know, what was it like to see me play? And then you can add your comments, but don't get technical. Don't critique their game. Just be there for them and turn it back on them. Well, what did you think? How did you play? How do you think you played? What was it like being out there? And because parents shouldn't get technical with their kids, because that's not their job.
Mm-hmm.
Coaches often do the technical stuff. And one of the key aspects of creating ownership in your kids is that everybody has a job to do. It's the kid's job to work hard, to take advantage of every opportunity they're given, and to appreciate every opportunity they're given. It's the coach's job to prepare the kids technically, physically, mentally for play, or for teachers in terms of education, and to make sure it's fun and interesting. It's the parent's job to write the check, provide the resources, the equipment, make sure the kids get where they need to go on time, and to support and love their kids. The problem comes in when anybody starts to do the other person's job. So if parents are constantly bugging their kids to work, to do their homework or to practice, or they're working on doing technical stuff with their kids, if everybody does their job and doesn't do anybody else's job, typically everybody's happy, and the kids generally do pretty well. And a few other thoughts about ownership. This is something in my book, is three words, capitalized, italicized, underlined, and exclamation pointed. Three words I tell parents: get a life. Get a life.
I like it.
what that means, Heather, is that if you have a life of your own that's meaningful, satisfying, and affirming, you won't need to place that responsibility of your happiness on your children's shoulders. And by the way, I'm often asked after these talks about positive pushing from moms, from stay-at-home moms, well, do you mean get a job? And I said, no, I know a lot of people who have jobs who have no lives. I said, when you have something in your life that gives you validation other than your kids. And if you have a life, you're not going to have to place your life on your kids' shoulders, because that is a crushing burden.
Right. Let's go back one more time to the tennis thing. Let's say your kid decides that they want to quit. What do you suggest?
Yeah, it's a very popular question. A couple of thoughts on that. First of all, if they signed up for a season or a series of lessons, then you have to make them remain committed to it. Unless there's something incredibly unhealthy going on, they need a commitment to, in this case, tennis. It could be a musical instrument, whatever it is. They made a commitment to it, but they didn't just make a commitment. You as parents also made a commitment of money and time. So, and kids need to learn that just because something's not very fun or something's a little challenging, they can't just bail out. Because as adults, we can't do that. We still have to go to work even when it's hard. We still need to clean the house up even when we don't want to do it. And so teaching that value of commitment by requiring them to finish out the commitment of the sports season or a series of lessons, violin lessons, let's say, and then reevaluate. Because not everything kids do is going to be something they're going to do the rest of their lives.
Right.
So then they have to complete it and then make a decision, reevaluate, and say, well, do I want to do this again? Because I think what happens to a lot of kids is when they first start something, it's hard. I would use the example of a piano. The first, I don't know how long, months or a year, it's not fun playing the piano because basically you stink and it's hard. But then kids often will get over what I call the hump of achievement, where all of a sudden they start to develop some competency. They're able to play that tune and they go, wow, this is actually fun. And so whenever any kids are doing something at first, yes, it's hard, but life is hard. And kids need to learn that even when it's difficult, they can't just bail out. But then, again, at the end of the season or the lesson commitment, they can reevaluate, and they might decide not to do it. But what's very important is doing nothing is not an option. That's a big rule for me. Kids, doing nothing for kids is not an option. They have to do something. So they have to pick another sport, something performing arts, computer stuff, whatever it might be. But kids have to do something. Because there's some saying, it might be from the Bible, I'm not sure, something like idleness is the devil's playground.
Right.
If you ask kids why they do stupid things, the number one answer is because they were bored. And if they're doing something, if they're involved in some activities, especially ones that they really care about, then they're less likely to get in trouble. And by the way, another key component of creating ownership in your kids is to help them find a passion. Help them find something that they care deeply about. Now, you can't force a passion on your kids. Some kids find a passion at 6, some at 16. Some people don't find a passion until they're 60. But having a passion is an incredibly powerful thing in kids' lives because not only will it help them become successful and happy, but it might save their lives. And let me explain that. If kids are really passionate about something, they're going to be pretty successful at it because they're going to work at it unbelievably hard. They love doing it. Plus, they're going to be happy because they're doing something they love. Also, in terms of saving their lives, let's think about you've got a 15-year-old. It's Friday night. They have the option. And let's say they love playing soccer. There's a soccer game the next day. Some friends of theirs who don't have a passion say, hey, let's go out drinking and driving around. And so you're starting to think for a minute, yeah, it might be kind of fun doing that, but I really want to play well in the soccer game tomorrow. So I'm going to go to bed early, so I'm going to say no. That alone can keep kids from going down the bad road.
Very good point. So if you have been doing a lot of the praising stuff with your kids, how do you tell them that you're not going to do that anymore, that you've been robbing them of their own personal journey and that you're not going to praise them anymore?
No, just stop.
Why would you not tell them?
They don't need to know because praise is a very subtle thing, and they might not, at a very conscious level, know the difference. But so just change the way you start praising your kids. And they might notice, depending upon how old they are, but they said they might not notice. You know, if they're 7 or 8, they might not notice, or younger. But if you just change the way you praise, then you're going to send very different messages, much more important and valuable messages than just saying something as lazy and worthless as, you know, good job.
Mm-hmm. So what are some phrases? People love it when you give them phrases
right.
to help them out. What are phrases that empower the child as opposed to praising? What are some phrases that
sure.
you would offer?
Okay. The overall basic concept is look at when a kid's done something well. Think about what enabled him or her to do that well. So again, going back to the example before, in a soccer game, maybe your little soccer player was really focused the entire game, didn't look over the sidelines, didn't goof around, totally focused. So you say, you were really focused during the game. Or maybe the girl's got a recital coming up and has a great recital. You know, you put in a lot of time practicing to have that great recital. So you're identifying what enabled them to become successful, and then you're focusing them on that thing that enabled them to become successful. So then the kid says, oh, I worked hard. I put in a lot of hours to have that great recital. Gee, maybe for the next recital, I'll do that again.
Okay, cool. So you said that there were three pillars. One is self-esteem, one is ownership. What's number three?
Emotional mastery. And this is, for me, the last piece of the puzzle of raising successful achievers, and yet it's probably the most neglected. There's a growing body of research that shows that our ability to master our emotions is as important as intelligence, as a lot of other qualities, as ability, if it's a sport-related or the performing arts-related. And yet these days, where do kids learn about emotion? From popular culture? My gosh, in popular culture, movies, TVs, videos, whatever, you see people who are either totally emotionally repressed or totally emotionally out of control. Or they learned it from their parents. Well, a lot of parents aren't the best emotional role models, you know, because they get angry, they get frustrated, they yell at their spouses, things like that. I think there should be courses, a part of every curriculum at every school should have a component on emotional mastery. Because think about all the emotions that children feel in any given day. Fear, frustration, anger, disappointment, sadness. Also, hopefully, they feel some excitement and joy and elation and contentment and so on. And so the real challenge then is to help kids to get that kind of emotional mastery. Now, a couple of red flags to look for with respect to emotional mastery. Fear of failure is one where kids are just terrified of failing. And by the way, fear of failure is a whole other workshop, a whole other interview, but it's an incredibly powerful and destructive issue. Other things are unhappy successes. I mentioned this earlier. I work with a lot of young achieving kids, high achieving kids who are just really, really unhappy. Other emotional red flags include, here's a great one, emotional overprotection, where kids, parents don't want their kids to feel bad. And so what they do is they don't allow them to feel sadness or upset or anger or what have you. And so the only way to develop an emotional mastery is for kids to be able to feel their emotions. And parents hate to see their kids feel bad, like I mentioned earlier. So they swat them, they placate them, they distract them. And yet kids need to feel bad. Because only by experiencing emotions can kids, in fact, learn to deal with their emotions. Another red flag is kids who are emotionally out of control, if their emotions are out of proportion to the situation. So that they have a bad game and they're just totally devastated. Or their sibling pulls a toy away from them and they totally have a tantrum. These are red flags of kids who aren't developing emotional mastery, and it should be real eye openers for parents in terms of of what's going on with their kids emotionally. And this is not any kind of serious, you know, clinical problem. These are just the kind of things that a lot of kids struggle with. But parents, I think, don't spend enough time with helping their kids develop emotional mastery. Because emotional mastery is not feeling emotions. Emotional mastery is being able to experience emotions, being able to identify the emotion they're feeling, be able to understand the cause of the emotion, and then to be able to express the emotion in a healthy way. Because that's really what separates adults, emotionally mature adults. And by the way, not all adults are emotional masters, obviously, from children. You know, we as adults get angry, we get frustrated, we get scared, we get disappointed. But we've learned that hopefully to express these emotions in a healthier, more constructive way. And so the real challenge is how to develop emotional mastery in your children. A couple of thoughts on that. First of all, you have to know your emotional baggage. And I touched on this early in the interview when I talked about needing to push themselves and understand themselves. A colleague of mine said something that I think is absolutely brilliant. He said this: a parent's unconscious is their child's reality. I'll repeat that. A parent's unconscious is their child's reality. This means that whatever emotional baggage you have, if you're an angry person, a sad person, a fearful person, the chances are if you don't know that baggage, you're going to give that baggage to your children. Because if you're a fearful person, you're going to send messages to your children about the world, that the world is a dangerous place. And your kids are going to pick up on that. Also, as I already touched on, you want to allow your children to experience all emotions. Because emotions are two sides of the same coin. Kids can't feel happiness, excitement, and joy unless they're also willing to experience hurt, pain, anger, sadness, and so on. And so parents, of course, as I said before, hate seeing their kids sad, and yet you have to allow them to be sad. You need to allow them to be angry and frustrated because with experience, they learn how to figure it out. Another key point about developing emotional mastery is what I call emotional coaching. When your kids are upset or feeling a certain negative emotion, coach them through the experience. So what are you feeling? What upset you? What is it feeling in your body? When I feel this way, sometimes I get this real knot in my stomach. And then show them how to express it. Instead of hitting your sister, maybe you could say, what you did was really made me mad, or please don't do that again. Now, they're not going to get this the first time around, but if you constantly emotionally coach your child and give them these opportunities, these other ways of dealing with their emotions, give them tools to deal with their emotions, then they have a better chance of internalizing these, and this is what, in fact, creates emotional mastery.
So what are some things that you see parents do that robs emotional mastery?
One is, like I said earlier, they don't allow their kids to feel bad. Their kids are upset, so they give them a toy or give them a piece of candy, anything to keep them from feeling bad. I've seen a lot of parents, when their kids are upset, they'll downplay it. They will say things like, don't worry about it. There's no reason to be upset. There's no reason to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the message the kids get there? That if they're feeling this way, but there's no reason to feel this way, well, not only am I feeling really bad, but I must be stupid because my parents are saying that I shouldn't feel this way. And so it's very important for parents to be real about emotions, to understand that if they're upset, and that's okay, that's part of life, and then what they can do to guide them through the upset.
So how do you, let's say your child, let's go back to the child who's getting a C or a D on the report card. What would be some phrases that a parent could use that would help the child become more internally motivated?
Okay. Well, I think I already answered this question earlier, but But bottom line is for the child needs to take ownership of it. And by the way, a C might be as good as the child can get. You know, not everybody, every kid can get an A or a B, and parents need to be realistic about that. But also then to ask the child, so, you know, why did you get that C? Did you put in the time? Did you listen, pay attention? Did you do the reading? You want to look for, help the child understand the reasons behind behind the grade that they got. And because if it's in controllable terms, then they can do something about it. They can work harder in the future.
I'm sorry. I should ask a different question. Do you ask the child what grade they want to get?
That's a whole other angle to this. Is beforehand, what is their goal? And some of them might say straight A's. Some of them might say, you know, mostly A's or B's. There's nothing wrong with having outcome goals. The problem is that they focus too much on the outcomes. And the reality is, Catherine, we live in a culture where it's all about results. Results matter. Kids don't get ahead in life for being good kids or hard workers. They get ahead for their results. But a lot of parents have the misconception that if you focus on the results, that's likely to increase the chances of getting that result. But in fact, it's just the opposite. Because let's think about a sporting event like a running race. When does the result of a running race occur? Well, obviously at the end when they cross the finish line. And so if your kid is focused on the finish line, what are they not focused on? The process, the thing between the start and the finish, what they need to do to get that result that they want. Also, I mentioned fear of failure earlier. If kids are focused on the finish, on the result, that's what causes fear of failure, because one result that they're terrified of is failure. So by having focus on the result, they're less likely to achieve that result. So what you should do is, yes, of course, we live in a result-oriented society, find a set some sort of outcome goal, top five in the race, semifinal of the tennis match, mostly A's and B's. But then as soon as you and your child set that outcome goal, turn their focus away from the outcome onto the process. So now, that's your outcome goal. What do you need to do to achieve it? Well, in tennis, I need to practice 3 times a week. I need to listen to my coach. I need to not give up. I need to work on my technique, whatever it might be. Because here's the irony. If you get your kids to focus on the process, how are they likely going to perform? Well, pretty well, because they're focusing on the things that will enable them to, in fact, perform well. Then, if they perform well, what's the likely outcome going to be? The very outcome you wanted in the first place. So that's another big mistake parents make, is being totally focused on results, because, of course, results matter. But by focusing not on the results but on the process, they're more likely to get the results they want.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, what I'm going to do now, Dr. Taylor, is I'm going to turn on the callers so that they can ask you questions. So
sure.
Did you have anything else that you want to say before we turn it over to the group to ask you questions?
Let me just mention one last thing, maybe I'll have a little time at the end to pull things together, but I think one of the greatest obstacles to raising successful and happy children is fatigue. It's just fatigue. Parenting these days is hard. A lot of families have both parents work. Their lives are very busy. It's tiring. And one of the most dangerous words in parenting is expediency.
Is what?
Expediency. What is expediency? Expediency is basically taking the easy road, doing what's easiest for you, not what's in your children's best interest. And the reality is that parenting is hard work. And yet, when you have kids, you sign up for it. So it's really important to think in terms of what is in your child's best interest. It's a big phrase for me. What is in your child's best interest, and just doing the job because it's hard. Okay, you can open it up to callers now.
Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
Okay, what's your name?
So I have one of these children that has trouble with emotional mastery. And my experience when I try to move into helping them identify their feelings is I get blasted and with very angry outbursts and sometimes physical outbursts. That doesn't seem to work very well in the moment. So my question is, do I just wait until – it's just hard to get past the initial emotional outburst and how to deal with that in the moment when you're in the car, when you're in the house. So that's my question. How do I get past that point where he's very amenable to talking about it afterwards, but in the moment it's crazy.
Yeah, in the moment it's very challenging. Many kids, when they're in that moment, you can't. It's difficult for them to step back and reason. And what you're really trying to do when you try to engage in emotional coaching is to reason with them. But if they're in a very emotional state, they're often not very open to that. And especially, I don't know how old your kids are, but certainly as they head towards their teens, they're going to be less and less interested in talking to parents about these sort of things. So
he's 11.
He's heading in that direction. In that case, allow him to be upset, but not to be mean or angry. So if he wants to cry and be upset about something, you know, that's his right. But you need to set a limit on what's appropriate. And you're engaging in emotional coaching when you say, okay, I know you're upset, I know you're angry, but it's unacceptable to yell at me or to hit your sister.
Right.
So that right there will help shape in the moment, provide a limit of what's appropriate for this coaching there. And then after the fact, when he's calmed down and you've indicated that you can do this, that then have a conversation with him. So when we're in the car, you were really upset. You want to tell me what's going on? It's a really important thing to keep in mind is that when kids are angry, they're not really angry. That's not the underlying emotion. And I see so many kids get labeled as having anger management issues or control issues. And when kids are angry, anger is never the underlying issue. Anger is a defensive, protective emotion. And it protects kids from deeper, more hurtful emotions, such as loneliness, rejection, shame, humiliation. And so when you have an angry kid, even though it's really hard as a parent, I know the feeling, to be able to step back yourself and say, what's really going on here? That's really what you need to do to be able to show, to be able to really get at, okay, my kid's angry, but angry is not the real issue. What's really going on here? And it might be in terms of what's going on right in the car at the moment, or it might be something going on at school, and you just happen to be the best outlet for it. So to pull it all together, have them set a limit on their behavior in the moment, and then later on have a conversation where you can help them, where you can coach them and give them ideas. So next time it happens, they might get in that same situation and go, oh, I remember that conversation. I'm going to try doing something differently emotionally.
Right. We do some of that already. And the other thing I run into is that he the pattern I see is when he has a performance coming up, the week before that is when he reacts that way most often, but he denies that he's feeling any stress about that event. So I don't really know how to get past that.
Yeah, I think in that situation it's not uncommon that the kids get stressed out before a performance, a game, whatever it might be. And I think just keeping provide perspective, focus on the process, focus on helping them be prepared and feeling confident about what's coming up. And then so again, set limits, and if you start to act out in the stress toward you, then say, okay, I know you're a little stressed out here, but that's not acceptable.
All right, thank you.
Okay, who else has a question? We have time for maybe one or two more.
Okay, I'll throw in one.
Hello, I have a question.
Okay. Sticking with the tennis analogy, right? I got an 11-year-old boy, signed up for something. And, we talked about it multiple times before we signed up. And, we're halfway through the process now, and he doesn't want to do it anymore. And, you know, I'm going back and forth on whether I continue to push him to tell him that it's going to be to his credit if he goes ahead and, you know, finishes it off or stays back. What are the typical red flags there, Dr. Taylor, that I should watch out for?
How old is he?
He's 11.
He's 11.
Yeah, very old 11, though.
Very old 11, okay. I don't think there are necessarily red flags in terms of concern. Even at that age, they're still finding things that they want to do. And I wouldn't talk to them in terms of, oh, it will be to your credit if you stick with it. I would simply say that something along the lines of a value in our family is commitment. And that you made a commitment to this set of lessons, let's say, or and also we paid for it, and we're driving you. So it's a family commitment. So we simply expect you to fulfill your commitment. At the end of the the lesson series or whatever it is, then we can reevaluate. But unless there's something really, really unhealthy going on there, you know, an abusive coach or somebody picking on him badly, I think you should have to stick with his experience, because you don't want to teach kids that they can just bail out of anything that's uncomfortable.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
I have a question if you have time for one more.
Sure.
Hi. I have two very young kids, a boy who's 4.5 and a daughter who's 2.5. They're as different as night and day, but our son, who's 4 going on 40, you know, very early reader, you know, read at the age of 3, almost 2.5, very aware, very alert, and so he takes everything in and upon himself. He's actually a worrier more so than my husband and I are. And we see him getting stressed and just taking on so many of the emotions of the day, that we want to help give him some tools to really manage his emotions, like you were saying. Everything to him is, you know, when he doesn't get, the toy goes away or something falls on the floor and, you know, it's, oh, no, you know, and it's very stressful for him. It's very black and white. And my husband and I have been really careful about not doing the good jobs and the, you know, like praising for everything and getting stressed out when things happen. We're really pretty easy going when it comes to that stuff. So I'm sure we have some responsibility for it, but also he just really takes it on himself. So I'm wondering if you can offer some tips for us for young kids about how to really, like, before the emotion gets so high, we can talk him down once the emotion gets high. We can talk to him about how he's feeling, and let's use some words to describe that and get him to take some deep breaths and calm himself down. But in that moment when he's, before he works himself up, are there things that we can give him, some tools, some thoughts to help him navigate his own emotions? Because I know we can't do it for him, but I want to at least help him.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, some kids are just born emotionally very sensitive. And you can just say, well, they're just sensitive kids and won't react this way, but genes are not destiny. And that, especially for kids who are very emotionally sensitive, it's especially important for you to teach them this process. It sounds like you've got a pretty good start. And keep in mind that kids, especially that age, aren't going to get the messages you send them right away. They just don't have the wherewithal. So don't give up doing what you're doing. My new book that's coming out in May is about sending healthy messages to your kids. And the biggest thing about it is that the parents need to continue to send messages to their kids, you know, for days, weeks, months, sometimes years before they act on it. But parents can't give up just because their kids don't seem to get it. So that issue of a very emotionally sensitive kid, you want to recognize and respect emotionality, but also don't be overly placating and comforting. You don't want to spoil them emotionally, because in the real world, life won't coddle them emotionally. So if you spoil them, they're going to develop this expectation that the world will do the same, and that's not healthy.
Okay.
So what you want to try to do is, if you sow sort of ahead of the curve intellectually, it sounds like, beforehand, what are some common, identify some common situations in which he will react, and then talk to him about what are some other ways of reacting. So you're giving him tools in his toolbox. This is a metaphor I use a lot. Tools in his toolbox that in those situations when something spills or something doesn't go right, he can pull that tool out and go, oh, yeah, this is something. This is another way of handling it. And because in the moment, he's not going to have the wherewithal to say, okay, what can I do here? But if you talk to him about it, maybe you role play a little bit those situations. If something gets knocked down, he starts reacting. they'll have a keyword like stop or calm or breathe. And that can then give him another option to dealing with these situations. So I guess just to wrap this up as best I can without knowing him is to respect and appreciate his emotionality, give him but definitely make efforts to help him to gain control of it, and then preemptively identify those situations where he often reacts, and then give him some tools for his toolbox that he can pull out when it happens. You might have to remind him to pull out the tools. And just stick with the messaging. Stick with it over and over and over again, because he might just not have the emotional control yet to implement some of these things. But if you keep putting it into his mind, getting those messages, then in time, he will likely get them.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take us off. I'm going to put us all on mute except for Dr. Taylor, and then I'm going to give Dr. Taylor a chance to wrap things up and to tell us where to contact him. So, and I put you all back on mute.
Okay. I guess I'd like to conclude with some one final thought, and then I'll share a little bit about my work and so on.
Okay.
Parents have a tremendous power over their kids, and to influence them either positively or negatively. And it's obviously a terrifying responsibility being a parent, but also an incredibly inspiring one. Because we can do an unbelievably bad thing to our kids, but we also have the power to do incredibly wonderful things for our kids. So what I really encourage parents to do is to be positive, conscious, and active forces in their children's lives. Positive meaning sending mostly positive messages to their kids. Not all, you don't have to be 100% perfect. Kids are resilient little creatures, so mostly positive. Conscious, as I mentioned several times before, knowing what you bring to the table, knowing your emotional baggage, and making sure that you're sending the messages to your kids that you want to send. And then active. Parenting is not a part-time job. It's a full-time job that's exhausting, but parents have the opportunity every moment of every day to send their kids those positive messages. With that said, a little bit about me. They can go to my website, which is drjimtaylor.com, drjimtaylor.com, or just Google Dr. Jim Taylor. I have a bi-monthly e-newsletter and video newsletter on YouTube that they can sign up for, where every other month I pick a topic and write about it. I also have three parenting books. The first one, Catherine mentioned, I think even the second one, Your Children Are Under Attack, which is about the importance of instilling in children really healthy values. Plus, I have a new book coming out in May called Your Children Are Listening, 9 Messages They Need to Hear from You. And this book is all about understanding how you send messages, what gloss messages, and how you can send the healthiest messages to your kids, because they're going to be getting really unhealthy messages from all other sources in their world, such as pop culture and their peers. But that book and the other books you can learn about and order online. If I can get any assistance directly, I consult with families all over the world, in fact, and they can contact me through my website as well. So I guess that's pretty much about it. So, Catherine, thanks very much. It was very, very enjoyable.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Taylor. I really, really appreciate your time, and I love the way you think. It's amazing.
Thank you very much. Thank
all
you
right.
very much.
So thank you all for being a part of tune in for your parenting tune-up. And our next program will be All You Have to Do is Look Inside and Into the Bully Victim. And Pam Dunn will be doing that workshop on Tuesday the 15th at noon Eastern time. So again, thanks for being here. And for those of you who have been here, we will be downloading this to you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Catherine, are you there? Catherine? Catherine?